Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Nora Vincent, whose latest book is Voluntary Madness, subtitled My Year Lost and Found in the Loony Bin. Earlier book is Self-Made Man, One Woman's Year Disguised as a Man. A former columnist at the LA Times, Salon Online, and before that, The Village Voice. Self-Made Man was your first book. Why did you decide at that point to move into the area of books? Had you gotten tired? Were you planning on it? Or did it just happen because you saw that you could get away with it?
You know, I think writing columns, especially political columns, didn't really appeal to me in the end. I did it because I wanted to be a writer, and the first thing I had published happened to be a polemical kind of piece. So I went with that for a while. But I think that I found, first of all, that I was probably more of a centrist than I really was writing as, and or at least I evolved into that. And I found it very difficult to be a centrist and find a home as a journalist. I think that every place, most of the places that were available were left or right, and you really didn't have room to be in the middle. And then also, I actually took a very short-term job as a radio person, actually. And I really realized that I loved the idea that you could ask the questions rather than pretending you knew the answers. And I guess this book writing was my way of starting to do that, especially in immersion journalism, was trying to go into the gray area and enjoy the gray area rather than making arguments, which I've never really been that fond of.
We're going to go a little bit into your punditry experience further down the road, because you were there writing and apparently, you know, getting more and more upset about the writing you felt you needed to do as time went on. I want to discuss that with you, because obviously here in Berkeley and even elsewhere, we never get an in into that side of punditry, and certainly what you get on Fox News is all polemic. Mm-hmm. So I want to go into that a little bit. But first, I want to talk about these books in particular, mm-hmm. because it seems to me that in one case, disguising yourself as a man, and in the other case, getting yourself locked up in three different institutions, as it turns out, more locked up is in quotes, but close to that, what you thought could be locked up in three institutions, is taking an awful risk with your life. And in the first case, it led to a depression, which led to the idea for the second.
Yeah. Well, I think that is something I've always been attracted to also, is the extremes to some degree, or throwing myself into something, because to me that seems easier somehow than research or the kind of traditional journalism, I guess. Finding where I meet my subject matter or overlap with it is something that just really, really inspires me. I've always felt like an outsider in whatever culture I've been a part of. And both of these books are driven by, first of all, the idea of being a gender outsider, that I've always existed as an androgynous person. And then The Voluntary Madness is really about having struggled with depression for so much of my life and being labeled in one way or another, whether it be anywhere on the spectrum from odd to nuts, and wanting to take those parts of myself and see if I could apply them to the culture at large and see, well, where do I bang up against this larger culture, and can I shed some light as an outsider on what it means to be an insider?
But at the same time, it would seem to me that there's also been this pull between being the observer and being the actor at the same time, and it's got to be hard to separate in both cases.
Yeah, I think that I don't observe those boundaries very well. I've never been a person who's very good at boundaries, and I suppose the psychiatrist would tell me I have borderline personality disorder, but I think that that's precisely what thrills me, and thrill is really the thing, at least in the first book. I grew up in the theater. My mother was an actress. I think I always had that idea that, well, what if you could take what happens on a stage or in a play, or what excites us all in art? What, you know, why do we go to the movies? Why do we read books? Because it's fantasy. We're looking through the keyhole. We want to think, well, what if? But what if you get to live the what if, you know? And so that's really what that was, is taking growing up with Shakespeare and all these drag roles and thinking, well, what if I could really make all the world a stage? And so when I did pass, it was incredibly thrilling. So, yes, I mean, it was dangerous to some degree, and obviously in the end it was emotionally very detrimental, but it ended up being very worth it. And it what led me into it in the first place was a very natural instinct.
But it's also, as you describe it, it almost seems, rather than journalism, moving into the realm of performance art.
That's right. And I think that's probably a much better way to say it. I used to try to say to people that it was artistic anthropology, because I think I'm a frustrated artist. I think I'm not a novelist. I don't really have the imagination for that. That's one of the other reasons I moved away from writing about politics. I'm still finding what it is that I really want to write about. And I think it is something along those lines where it's based in what happens in the real world. It's not fictional. It's not fantasy. And yet, it is about performance. It is about the vagaries of human lives and human stories.
There are two other elements going on that are interrelated. And one is that, in essence, for both books, you put yourself into a closet that you couldn't get out of. That's a two-way street, because on the one hand, you're lying, mm-hmm. and on the other hand, they're listening to lies. Mm-hmm. They're being deceived. How do you, particularly when you're dealing with your own psychological issues in talking to shrinks, how do you deal with that complexity?
I always think that the most remarkable thing that anyone ever said about this is Oscar Wilde, of course, which is you give a man a mask and he'll tell you the truth. And I think that's something that I really operated according to in this kind of journalism, that it always seemed to me that if people knew you were a journalist, or if people knew that you were trying to get inside, they would change what they said. So that entailed a certain amount of lying. Now, part of what happened at the end of Self-Made Man and what brought on this depression is that I'm not comfortable with lying. And that may sound strange, given that I made a whole practice out of it in this book. That was the presumption of it. And yet it was painful, and I didn't see a way around it to get at what I really wanted to get at, which was a lie as an avenue toward the truth, or maybe a greater truth. That has always been a difficulty, and it's always come up, and it's presented more discomfort actually in that book, in Self-Made Man, because I got to know people so personally over longer periods of time, and I had to really deal with revealing myself to them.
Well, when they found out, did you ever get any response from any of the people you dated?
Yeah, I mean, I think some of the people, most of them took it quite well. Some of them, understandably, were really annoyed, and there was that aspect of feeling used or feeling that they'd been a guinea pig unwittingly. But for the most part, I think people really understood what I was trying to do, and once they got past that initial shock, they said, yeah, I understand why it was important for you to do it this way, and I'm actually glad that I was part of it, because I learned something too.
Before we get to Voluntary Madness, I want to go a little more into what you think now, having stepped away for a couple of years, what you think you've taken away from it, and how dressing as a man has changed you as a woman.
I still, and I think I always will, it's a similar conclusion to the new book, I'll never be normal. I'll never look like a woman is supposed to look, according to our culture. I will always feel like an alien among women, or most women. But then again, I will always feel like an alien among queers. I've never felt that I fit there either.
Why not?
Well, I don't know exactly. It may be an aversion that I have to groups in general. It may be that I don't like the idea of an identity that's thrown over you like a blanket. Partly, of course, politically, I differed from many of my peers in the queer community, and I think I still do, although perhaps less vehemently than I did. Politics is so much a part of the queer community that it's difficult to find an alignment without that agreement. But, you know, what I've taken away, I guess, is that sense that I will never just be able to sit back and exist in whatever gender identity I have. I mean, for example, right now, you're looking at me. My hair is much longer now than it's actually been in quite some time. For me, this is long. And that's partly because I got really tired even after the project. I mean, up until a few months ago, I was still getting surd, and I was still getting, and I just finally decided, you know what, I just don't want to deal with this right now. I've dealt with it for many years, and so I'm going to capitulate a little bit, and I'm going to grow my hair out, and if I really hate it, then I'll cut it again, but I don't actually hate it. So it's an odd thing to think, well, having long hair and being able to play with your hair and somehow, you know, it's a strange thing, but it sounds so superficial, and yet it actually is kind of profound, I have to say.
During your years as a man, did you notice anything about being a man that when you told men about it afterward, they said, oh, no, you got that wrong?
There's always some people who will say that, but I've gotten a tremendous number of letters and responses of people saying, you really described my experience, or you actually helped me to think about my experience in a way that I hadn't. As I say, it's impossible that everyone would say that, and there are always people who will say, well, you got it completely wrong, or you got it from a woman's point of view, which invariably it was. And that's something that there's no way to get around, and that doesn't bother me. I feel that that wasn't really the point of the book, and never would be, or either of the books, is to get some concrete view. In fact, I stubbornly want to shift the view. It's a prism that keeps moving. So if you're feeling that, you know, you've gotten something concrete out of it, you're probably missing what I'm trying to do.
Now, voluntary madness takes place in three institutions, Meriwether, St. Luke's, and Mobius. Are these the real names of the institutions?
No, they're all pseudonyms.
I assume, therefore, that everybody in it is a pseudonym, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes the pseudonyms are a little bit off the charts, but those might actually be their nicknames?
No, some of them I just made up. Either they sounded somewhat like Mr. Clean, for example, sounded like this person's last name, and also he happened to be somewhat dirty, so that was a kind of a joke.
When you set this up, did you know that the first one, that you would go from levels of discomfort toward comfort, that you wanted to go from a public hospital to a private hospital to New Age-ish treatment center? That was the original idea.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I planned to do it, in a kind of divine comedy way of going through hell first, but I did think I want to get the worst over with, and I knew, I was pretty sure that the public hospital was going to be worse.
Well, when they locked those doors in the public hospital, did you suddenly get that scary feeling that you might never get out?
I was very scared. The first night, I remember thinking, I'm such an idiot. You know, I really was terrified in the emergency psych area, which was in the basement of the hospital, and it was scarier than the ward itself. I did have some things in place. I had my publisher was on call, my agent and my friends, people like that, who I thought, well, at least they can write letters, or they could even come in person if necessary to say, no, this person is in fact a journalist and is doing this project. But nonetheless, as I say in the book, you, even if you're a journalist doing a job in a place like that, you will lose your perspective very quickly.
In terms of the first one, Meriwether, it's all about drugs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very much a holding pen, drug people up. To me, it felt as if everyone had kind of given up. The culture at large, by the way, too, that the idea that these people already had really fallen out of the communities they were in, so most of them were homeless. And then this was just another stage of that. I think at one point I called it the psychiatric poorhouse. It's a similar thing. You know, take the person who's uncomfortable for us and an eyesore to us and put them away out of our sight so that we don't have to look at them, we don't have to think about them.
Well, I keep thinking about the days when Reagan opened the loony bins and let them out, and the rest of us have to deal with people on the street now. And if the alternative is drugging them up and throwing away the key, that's as inhumane as leaving them on the street.
Yeah, and there is a very close connection between this, and there have been a lot of people who've studied this also with poverty, for example, the idea of a community solution where you take responsibility for either the poor or the insane in your midst or the homeless. You really say, okay, you live on our block. We're going to give you, each of us is going to feed you a meal once a week or whatever it is, and that you take that responsibility, and what you do then is you find that middle ground between leaving somebody out on the street or leaving them in a cell, and you also tend to accelerate the healing process or make it more possible because you are doing the very thing that these other solutions don't do, which is you're giving people a social network, and that can be incredibly important in maintaining mental health.
The other part about mental health in America is it's all about drugs, whether it be Prozac and Ritalin, or down to a whole pharmacopoeia of names that I don't know, and you do. And that brings up the question of the relationship of the drug companies, the symbiotic relationship of the drug companies to most of these doctors.
Yeah, well, it's astounding the number of doctors who have ties to these companies, financial ties. And they're not just financial ties, they're ties of influence. They are taken on these trips and they're encouraged to write directly, to write more prescriptions for this drug, for this reason. And also it goes even further. I mean, the pharmaceutical companies have their fingers in the pie at every step practically. They oversee many of the studies that then are ghostwritten by, again, the pharmaceutical companies, published in the journals where the pharmaceutical companies advertise. I mean, the influence goes all the way down the line to the FDA. So you have to ask yourself, I mean, that would be like, Philip Morris, giving us information about whether or not cigarettes are bad for us. You know, well, we've done this study and it shows that they're fine. That's pretty awful. And reading a lot about that really scared me. And it really made me angry. It's a tremendous violation of the public trust.
You know, going back to your libertarian roots, how does that affect you on a political level?
I think what it makes me say is I would like to see people taking more responsibility for their own health care and realizing I can't depend on my doctor to tell me what I need to know. And I need to do my own research. I need to question this. What you put in, I mean, as a libertarian, you'd say, what you put in your body is your own decision. Just figure out what it is that you're putting in your body and what it's going to do to you.
But the problem with that is that there's so much information. Where do you go when there's no filters?
Mm-hmm.
And to me, at that point, someone does need to be trusted because, you know, on virtually anything, we've seen what happens with unfiltered internet information and how it spreads. In the case of medicine, on some level, we want that filter. We kind of need it.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. The internet can be a circus in that sense, and you can't trust a lot of what you read on the internet. But on the other hand, I mean, maybe what it means is we need some other group, whether it be an advocacy group, maybe. I don't think that they're functioning in this regard, but I don't know for certain, say, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, NAMI. Some group that can serve as that kind of filter that says, look, this is what we've learned. This is what the drug companies aren't telling you. Some of the doctors are functioning in that way. I'm not saying that every doctor out there is corrupt or ignorant.
It's only when a lot of these drugs wind up being generic that we do find out the truth about their danger, and because there's no other way of knowing.
Yeah, because that's part of the marketing process, is the way they sell their new drug is they say, well, let me tell you about this old drug, and they start telling you things they didn't tell you before. I mean, every day in the New York Times I'm seeing pieces. There was just one yesterday about something like doubling your heart risk of a heart attack taking Zyprexa. I mean, you know, or some of these other atypical antipsychotics. I mean, we already know, we've already established, and this has happened through lawsuits too, that they cause diabetes and obesity. So, you know, and this is true of the other cholesterol drugs with heart problems. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff. And you're right, you can't lose your mind on the internet and believe everything you read. But on the other hand, you can't expect that your doctor is always going to know this or be willing to tell you it. So the best defense we have is being an informed and thoughtful and discriminatory consumer.
Assuming that you're in that position, whether it be in any of these hospitals, even, you know, maybe Mobius is a little more trustworthy, the more open place, but the fact that these doctors are going to listen to you. I did an interview several years ago with Marilyn French, who was dealing with cancer, and even though she did her homework, doctors looked at her as if she was insane, and when she objected, they sent her to a psychiatrist.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the arrogance among many doctors is truly appalling and really irritating. I've gotten to the point where I have a very low level of trust for the medical establishment, and I think that the only way that you can get around that is that there are good doctors out there, and you just have to find them, and you just have to remember that just because maybe only 2 in 10 are good, you can get them, you can find them, and they are trustworthy. I don't know. I suppose that's the best we can do it now.
It struck me in reading this that in all three areas, for different reasons in all three places, that number one, you have to be very careful about willing to commit yourself on your own.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, that if you do that, you have to be interested in helping yourself, because otherwise nobody's going to help you.
Well, and this is the political question. I mean, I think I try to talk about that a little bit. You know, the liberal idea, this is true in, say, in the public schools, the idea would be, okay, the system is broken. This is what I entered this project thinking. The system is so broken, we need to fix it. I want to expose it for what's wrong with it. And it does need to improve. And so you think, well, throw money at the problem. Maybe what the problem is it gets better if you've got better facilities. And to some degree, that's true. It's a necessary but not sufficient condition. What I found in the end was that at Mobius, where the treatment and the facilities were the best on offer, still, most of the people who went in and out of that place did not improve precisely because of this role of the personal will. And that's the libertarian angle that I didn't go in wanting to, you know, find, but it's really what I learned having done it myself and looking at the people I met.
My only objection to that is that some people don't have the will that you have. I've gotten to my point in my life at this point where I no longer project my experiences outward on what other people can do, because other people are different from me. They have different needs. They're stronger in areas and they're weaker. At my end, I understand what you're saying. I kind of question whether I can project outward like that. That's all.
Well, but on the other hand, I don't like the idea that, and this is something that's prevalent in the medical community, the idea that you've written someone off, or that you think, you assume because, say, you're a schizophrenic or you're depressed, you can't help yourself. And I don't know that any of us knows what the other person is capable of. And therefore, I almost think, why have the lower expectation, or why say, well, you can't help yourself? You're right, you can't project your own experience, but I guess I would like to see there be more faith. I mean, there are people who are doing work with schizophrenics, for example, where they've learned that you can make a difference in your illness as a schizophrenic, depending on what you decide to do. And this has been something that they've found out because they've sort of put away this idea that you have to write these people off, that they can't do it. And I don't like the idea of saying to somebody, well, you don't have what I have, so you can't do it.
At the same time, I quit smoking cold turkey when I was 23 years old after smoking 2 packs a day for like 7 years. And so for a long time, I went through the thought, well, if I could do it, anybody can. You know, that's not always the case.
Mm-hmm. Well, but on the other hand, quitting cold turkey would not necessarily have to be the way you'd have to do it. And
right.
There are degrees of the will. I think that everybody can say, for example, I would like to be better. I think, you know, yes, some people are stronger. Some people have a facility for certain ways of life. But I do think everybody can participate. I mean, that's a fundamental tenet of any aspect of human life, that you can, that you have an ability, that we all are endowed with an ability to change and to grow and to be better than we are.
To me, one of the things that I took away from Mobius, the third part of the book, because the middle section of the book is a good private hospital.
Mm-hmm.
It almost runs counter to your arguments because you happen to run into a great doctor,
mm-hmm.
which made it great for you. But the third place, it became clear that those people who were sent there because they had to be sent there, why would they care about improving this? The only ones who would really care are the ones who went there voluntarily, which says that the idea of sending someone to rehab or anger management classes, any of those kinds of courses for problems, you know, they're probably not going to solve anything because they either don't recognize or don't care.
Yeah, well, and I think that would extend to an asylum, taking somebody against his will, medicating somebody against his will in many ways. All of those things, you're right. I think those are things that they're not going to bring about the result that we're looking for. So then you have to try to get people to a place, and this is something that they had at Mobius that I think helped, of learning to take apart their experience and look at it in a different way so that they could get to the point of wanting to change. Now, again, you still have to have a certain openness. You have to realize somehow, and this is the big question in a public policy sense of, we figure, well, I want to go on eating my cheeseburger, but I want to take my Lipitor. To us, that's what freedom means. And on top of that, we want the government to pay for our health care. Well, I feel you have to participate and you have to be willing. So if you take away the damage that not doing anything for yourself is going to do, you'll take away the incentive to do better.
Nora Vincent, let's talk a little bit about your career early on. How did you get involved in the punditry biz?
Well, it happened really by accident, I guess. I was working in publishing, and I wrote this this piece that I had actually moved to New York, and I was trying to get a date. And so I went to every lesbian event that I could think of. And what that meant was that I became a little bit of an expert in the lesbian world of New York. I began to see patterns that I really felt fed up with. And so I wrote this sort of scathing piece. And at the time, Andrew Sullivan was working as the editor of the New Republic, and I sent it in. And I think because nobody in the lesbian world, aside from Camille Paglia, but she was really directing her ire at feminism, was criticizing the gay world. Some gay men were doing it. I think he said, well, this is new. So he printed it. And then I guess that's really what got the ball rolling, and that's why it was a moment of anger that ended up determining, I would say, the next few years of my life in terms of I wanted to write. People wanted me to write columns that annoyed people. And so I would wait till something annoyed me. I'd read the paper and I'd get angry, and then I'd write an angry column.
As you moved into the right-wing blogosphere and the right-wing punditocracy, were you always separate from that? Were you accepted into it as a person? Did you have dealings with any of the other people?
I did. I mean, that's part of what happened is you don't find a very easy home because the left rejected you as soon as you criticized anything about the gay world, for example. And then the right somewhat wanted to take you in for cynical reasons because they figured, well, we can use you to, make arguments that we can't make, which annoyed the hell out of me. I didn't want to be part of that. I didn't want to be the right wing's monkey. I also never felt welcome there because there's always that squeamishness. Well, you're a queer. You know, I mean, they can't even bring themselves to say any of those words. At the time when Clinton was in office, it happened to be a place where people were doing a little bit more thinking because they weren't in power. As soon as the Republicans came back into power, all of the creative thinking that was actually happening to some degree on the right or in semi-conservative circles disappeared. And that happens a lot. When your person is in power, that may very well happen with Obama. The creativity on the intellectual left, it may ossify a little bit because, you know, we'll see. I mean, I hope not.
How about the money angle? Was there extra money in being a right-wing pundit at your end or just writing?
No, not really. I mean, it was just, it was where I found a place, as they say, I think because I'd been mostly rejected by the left, this was someplace I could write. And then I ended up leaving it. I did meet some, what I thought of as enlightened editors, like at the Village Voice, who said, you know, I want you to come and write here because I would like to include some other voices. And that was true again at the LA Times, where they were trying to diversify the op-ed page. So they wanted me to come and write there for a while. So I did find temporary homes, but it was a fairly constant struggle trying, whether it be, I mean, I had pieces rejected both from more left-wing papers for being too far to the right or too far to the center, and the same on the other end, the conservatives rejecting a piece because it, you know, people were not ashamed to admit, well, we don't agree with you, so we're not going to publish it, you know, which to me seemed the cornerstone of free speech.
So there was never a time when you felt like you were, you might put yourself in a position of whoring. You would just back off and not write.
Well, that's what I eventually did. I think that there was a time when I was writing the best that I could. I would write pieces. I remember writing a piece in the beginning about the Iraq War and writing about doubt and saying that maybe the most conscientious thing you could do right now is have serious doubts and express those doubts. And even to write an op-ed about doubt, I mean, that's just not what op-eds are for. And so I think that was toward the end of my time, and I realized the more I tried to find a place for those pieces, the harder it got. And that's when I really decided it broke down a little bit where I stopped being able to write them. And so I took a little bit of a leave, and then I came up with the idea for this book, and that freed me in a way from writing columns anymore.
I guess at my end now, I look back on the lost 8 years, and I think a lot of people now look back on those years as lost in so many different ways. I wonder about the role of the punditocracy as a whole in giving the Bush administration the freedom to do the damage that they did, in essence prodding the mainstream media to stop questioning the Bush people until, of course, Katrina and it all fell apart.
People were so willing. You looked at this person and you thought, are you serious? You're really putting this person up for the presidency? I remember thinking that initially. And then all the way through, right down to the whole nuclear pronunciation. I mean, nobody was willing to say this guy is an idiot.
Where were you? Did you vote for him in 2000?
No, I didn't actually. I voted for Nader.
And by 2004?
I didn't vote for him. I'm trying to remember what I penciled in. I think I penciled in maybe McCain-Lieberman. I can't remember what I did at the time. You know, and this is something that's also been a problem for me. I didn't, as you saw when you read that op-ed, I didn't vote this time around because I didn't feel that I could put myself in one or other of the boxes. Now, I, as I said in this recent op-ed, that I may very well come to regret that I didn't vote for Obama in the sense that he may very well prove to fulfill his promise. And maybe some of the fiscal quibbles that I would have with what he might do, they may not come to fruition. So it'll be interesting for me to see what happens.
So in 2000, you were not on that Bush bandwagon.
No, I mean, I was really very heavily influenced at that time, actually, by Nat Hentoff. He's one of my heroes, and he was making the argument that we really needed a viable third party in this country, and that maybe the most patriotic thing you could do would be to vote for someone like Nader so that you could try to establish that. And that was really why I did that, and I still think that. I think we could benefit from having four or five parties are more like the French.
Going back to those days, did you make those feelings known in op-eds? And if so, what was the response from the right, which was pushing the hell out of Bush?
I think what I ended up doing is I gravitated to the people that I thought were trying to live somewhere in the middle and were, you know, willing to say, this guy's an idiot, are you kidding me? But there weren't very many people who were willing to do that.
And what about the run-up to the Iraq War? Were you one of the people who was saying, well, wait a second, something isn't working? I mean, I'm not a big fan, but even Andrew Sullivan bought into that.
As I say, I wrote this column about doubt, but I also wrote a column where I said, well, you know, what if we have this person who's there, who's been, you know, kicked in the teeth by Bush number one and is just sort of waiting around to give us the kickback? I was uncertain what I thought, and I wrote different columns expressing different points of view. I'm not sure that was particularly welcome, and that's part of, again, why I started to move away from that. I mean, I moved away from writing columns by 2002. So it wasn't very long before I, and you know, of course, 2001, I mean, 9/11, writing about 9/11, again, that was something that was difficult to do because I didn't agree, for example, with the people who were saying, you know, well, maybe we deserved it. They made me angry, and yet I didn't want to be one of the sort of knee-jerk flag wavers either, and I wanted to try to find some other ground.
It sounds to me, Nora Vincent, after having written Self-Made Man and Voluntary Madness and what you're saying now, that you're still very much a work in progress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's, I mean, you know, I think it's a benefit and it's also a detriment, and that is that I tend to do public therapy, you know, or public progress in terms of the path of life that I'm taking. I think these books are way stations along the path, and they're public, and so there's a lot that you can look at and say, wow, I can see all this private information that you're disclosing. So it's hard to talk about what you did a few years ago because you're not, I feel that I'm not the same person, and I'm continually changing, and whatever I write next is going to be a big departure from these. So yes, it very much is a work in progress, and I'm willing to say absolutely that I would shudder to think that I think exactly what I thought 8 years ago. I don't.
On top of that, you continued apparently with some of the therapy that started at the end of the book.
I'm not in therapy now. The book ended for me with the realization that I came to the center of myself and I saw an emptiness there. Now, there are a lot of people who would say if you are in spiritual circles that that's a good thing, that you've actually gone to the right place. You've seen what you're supposed to see. And I think that's my jumping off point for the next book is to say, okay, I came to the end of therapy in many ways. I went into this process. I saw the thing I needed to see. And now the process is, okay, what do I do with that information and where do I take it from there?
Nora Vincent, now that you've done that in a fascinating way in two books, what do you do now? Are you working on another book already, or are you?
Well, I'm working on the idea, and I am going to pursue something that I think will be, if this is the more grounded aspect, I think I'm going to take flight a little bit, and I'm going to be going probably in a more spiritual angle. And I don't know yet what that concretely is going to mean. I'm sure it'll be another immersion project that has other people and circumstances, but it's going to be very much me following what I think the next stage is for me.
Well, if you, after all this time in these hospitals, and it sounds like each step along the way, on some level, you were helped, even if it just told you what you shouldn't do, what would you tell the Nora Vincent of 1999 or 2000?
I would say don't take the meds if you can help it. I certainly was not suicidal to the point where I needed to do something immediately. I would say go into that scary place that you're running away from and figure out what you need to figure out. And even, you know, farther along the line, when I went into the bin for the first time before writing, where I got the idea to write this book, I would say, don't go, you know. I mean, now that I think about it, I think, well, the fact that I went brought me where I am now, so maybe it was a good thing that I did go. But I guess I really had to learn the hard way that those were the wrong paths, that those were not healing and that they weren't going to get me where I wanted to go.
And for the public at large, what do you think voluntary madness tells them on a broad scale? And again, you know, trying to remove whatever personal philosophical prejudices you have.
I guess I would say that I hope people will emerge with skepticism from it and an idea that you really do need to question the received wisdom about what causes or what is mental illness today and to remember that we are dealing very much in shadows. I just think skepticism is healthy. I'm not saying that you need to be an extremist and disavow medication altogether, but maybe just as I said before, to be more informed, to do some homework. There's a lot of good writing out there that's not on the internet, in book form, people who've done really good research. And all across the board, read the people who are for medication. You know, read Peter Kramer as well as other people. Discover for yourself what your point of view really is.
And it would seem that after all this, after listening to you and having this interview, it seems that if this, along with being a work in progress, there's also the idea that you're basically trying to be skeptical about all kinds of assumptions, no matter what they are.
I guess I've always thought that arrogance is a form of ignorance, and the reverse, too. I want to sit with the idea that there's a hell of a lot that I don't know. In fact, there's so little that I do know for sure. And I want to be comfortable with that. I like the idea of sitting in that discomfort of saying, you know, I really don't know what I'm doing. And that's okay.
You've been listening to an interview with Nora Vincent, whose latest book is Voluntary Madness, My Year Lost and Found in the Loony Bin. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.